Thank you, sir, and Chair Chairperson. Checking that on the day that Wednesday 14, don't we need that the year must be shown there on the front page?
14th, yes. Thank you very much. What is the day? What is the day? Last year, yeah, September 2016. Thank you. Page 2.
Just a little bit of a typographical or grammar issue. It's just the first paragraph where we refer to, she further noted that Justice Jasta, and I would suggest that it's not apostrophe A, but it should read that Justice Jasta has interpreted the impugned section 11 in the light of the object and purpose of the Act.
So that would be effective, the change would be effective. Any other correction on that page? If none, we shall go to page 3. Honorable Lakia.
Actually, from my reading, the first three paragraphs, actually also the top section of the previous page, paragraph is fine. It's just the paragraph that starts with Ms. Swart. It's just below the middle of the page 4. If you have the section, Jefferson, I will proceed. Ms. Swart clarified that the presentation was limited to the majority judgment, but also indicated that they did identify, instead of identified, they did identify a list of provisions in the Act that might be problematic. The next sentence, that list would be, I suggest it should be circulated to members. There's just the circulated is not there. She noted that the court stated for a removal to be effected, the disturbance must be of such a nature that the House cannot continue with its business within. Now it stops there within a reasonable, I suggest it should read period of time. Just to complete that sentence, to make sense. So that would be my correction. If there's no other objection to it, I will just proceed to the next paragraph, Chairman.
You all agree that those changes are necessary. Yes. Thank you. Next. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, just next paragraph, reading, Ms. Cuffin noted that in their research they found that in South African law, the term liable for damages, I would suggest it must read, was more widely used in legislative drafting than liable in damages. So just insert the word more there. And the next sentence should read, with regard to why, delete the should, with regard to why freedom of speech is limited in the rules and orders and not in the Act, comma, this comes directly from section 51(1)(a) of the Constitution.
Right. With that, one more.
Go ahead. Just the very last paragraph, Chairperson. Professor Mutamang, for clarity about what precincts include and whether it includes only the House or covers the premises of Parliament as a whole. Delete that one whole, because we already have it in the sentence. Okay, thank you, Chair. That's all for on this page.
Okay, that's page 3. The fourth of page 4. Thank you, Mr. Pierre. Any other correction? Here, there are no other corrections. Page 5. We are happy with page 5. Can we have a proposal for the adoption of the minutes? Any proposal for the adoption of the minutes?
Chairperson, I was absent, that's why I only did the grammar corrections. I can't verify for the
Yes, we have two new members, but all members have read the minutes and they are familiar with the substance, so it would do no harm for members to make a proposal. Proposal for the adoption of the minutes.
Chairperson, can we say we minute that we in principle support after the correction, but that we will have to formally adopt when we have members who can make a formal recommendation for adoption and second in terms of their participation in that particular meeting.
Can we get someone began to advise us?
I would agree with that, that there should be an in-principle agreement the adoption of the
federal meeting. So we would in principle accept the minutes. And then when all the other members are here, we will formally adopt them. But otherwise, we agree that there are no problems with the minutes. All the corrections have been made, and we are able to proceed on this basis. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are the methods that arise from this meeting? Ms. Gideon?
Chairperson, from my reading of the minutes, actually I think our agenda follows from what happened in that particular meeting. So I would suggest that we actually proceed to item 5 on the agenda, that we get the briefing, because I think we've adequately covered in the agenda all matters that emanate from the previous meeting.
Disagree with that, that basically the agenda items follow from the minutes that we have adopted in principle. Can we then move on to 5, 6, which are the questions? So those are the main business items that brings us here today. Honourable Kutelezis.
Thank you, Chair. I think the call is progressive. I support what you say.
Honourable Kutelezis, that approach. We're all happy. We'll take a briefing by NA table on international best practices and conventions relating to environmental power center links. Who is leading us? I see the committee secretary is running away.
She's leaving the presentation, Chair.
Okay.
Yeah, I told her to leave anyway.
Okay, fine. Honorable Mugoto, another member. Honorable better the minutes in principle, and the matters arising are actually the agenda item 5 and 6. So we are proceeding to deal with the item 5, and then which will be followed by 6. So we are calling on the NA table representatives to address.
Good morning, honorable members. I'll just do a quick briefing on the comparative study on the use of best practices and convention related to parliamentary powers and privileges. The paper, the research paper as a whole, is about 24 pages, and I'll just highlight critical methods that the committee would want to if the committee can recall, the committee had its first meeting on the 27th of May in 2016, whereby we were requested to conduct a comparative study on parliamentary powers and privileges to enable the committee to take on board experiences of other parliaments in its review processes of the Act. And in doing that, we compiled a questionnaire, of which consisted of 5 questions, that is on slide 2 of the presentation. We compiled this questionnaire, we had 5 questions, and we consulted with the chairperson with regards to the type of question that we're going to ask the parliament, and we circulated the questionnaire to 10 parliaments. However, we only received only 5 responses, mainly from the New Zealand, from Kenya, from Canada, from United Kingdom, as well as Australia. On slide 2, you have the Parliament's limitation of parliamentary powers and privileges. Does your parliament face any limitations on parliamentary powers and privileges? If so, how is this done? What developments have been there in terms of parliamentary powers and privileges in the parliament in the last 10 years? How does your parliament deal with the content of members, whether or not there are rules and regulations, rules and orders, legislation that deals with forceful removals of members, contempt and disruption? These are the questions that we circulated to the relevant parliament, and based on that we used this, and then we gave them, and then they responded based on those questions. So on slide 3, we felt that it is important to define what parliamentary privileges is, so we went to check what is parliamentary privilege based on SMA, based on SMA, and exactly what Gordon and Jack says about privilege. In that slide, it reads as follows. Privilege refers to specific rights or advantage, an exemption from a rule or a norm, which puts its possessor in a different position from everyone else. This right or advantage or benefit is reserved for a certain group, in this case in Parliament, that is the right that is enjoyed by members of Parliament. According to SMA, defines parliamentary privilege as a sum of certain rights enjoyed by each House collectively, every constituent part of the House Board of Parliament, and by members of the House individually, without which they could not discharge their function, and which exceed those possessed by other bodies or individuals. So basically, parliamentary privileges is preserve exclusive rights for members to freely attend to public affairs of the House without disturbance or interruptions, or to freely express themselves. from the free speech without fear from arrest or civil prosecution for that matter. Then we thought that it is important to also define what parliamentary privilege is, that you're also going to find in the Act itself, that is in Section 2 of the Powers and Parliamentary Act, which is similar to other parliaments as well, but with the exception with the Kenya Parliament, whereby this definition of parliamentary privilege is extended to parliamentary accommodation for members. We will now proceed with Kenya. That is slide 5. In Kenya, parliamentary powers and privileges are provided for in Article 117 of the Constitution of Kenya, as well as the National Assembly Powers and Privileges Act of 1952, which is now being repealed by the Parliamentary Powers and Privileges Bill of 2014. Now, this bill, I mean the Act itself of 1952, which was applicable to the National Assembly, however, it was also used in the Senate as well. So the new bill establishes that each house of the Parliament can establish a committee of privileges. The new bill creates new offences, penalties, code of conduct, and the disciplinary processes. Recently, that was on the 22nd of July in 2017, the President of Kenya signed this piece of legislation into law. So now it's the Parliamentary Powers and Privileges. So now it has been signed into law. In terms of limitation to parliamentary powers and privileges, Kenya noted that on issues relating to limitations of parliamentary powers and privileges, they referred to the United Kingdom and FMA for their guidance, and also referred to the rules, the National Assembly Standing Orders. They've recently amended their rules, their third edition, as of June 2017. With regard to forceful removal, they've got a standing order, which is 111 of the National Assembly. Before I go any further on this one, I would like members, if you do have the research paper with you, to go into page 6 and page 8 of the research paper, because that will lead the committee into the recent development that undertook in Kenya. Now, if for instance an incident takes place in the house in the beginning of the year, that means that the member that is found to be foul would be in suspension for the whole session, which is the whole annual year. That's how it was before this rule was amended. And that decision is undertaken as a step to do that. Now, this matter, then there was a case that happened last year in March in 2016, where we had a member called Honorable Opio Wandai. And other members of parliament who disrupted the sauna when the president was making a speech and by blowing their whistles. And this standing order did kick in and he was suspended for the rest of the session. And he took the matter and he challenged it. The matter was challenged in court. And the court order states the decision of the House, which means that it was temporarily suspended the proceedings of the House pending that there was a hearing and the determination of the judicial review application, which was filed by the member, that was suspended. In light of all this, the leader of the majority party in Kenya addressed this matter to the Speaker. And then they had to look into the suspending order as it stands, and in particular the disciplinary procedures. In particular the disciplinary procedures in the standing orders of the National Assembly, and they also had to look at whether or not the power of the House to make the standing orders and how far can the House provide for ordinary conduct of its proceedings. And also look into the privileges of the House itself. So the concern that the leader of the majority raised in this matter, he touched on the principle of separation of powers. The question was whether the court can pronounce itself on the internal rules and procedures of the National Assembly without encroaching on the principle of separation of powers. The Speaker referred the matter to the Committee of Privileges. The committee relooked the events that had that led to Honorable Wandai's suspension, and the committee looked at the experiences of other countries. So they went to check at UK, they checked in Australia, they checked in India, they checked in South Africa, in terms of sanctions for disorderly conduct of members during proceedings of the House. The committee made a recommendation on the matter of Mr. Wandai that they proposed that this order, which is as it stands, the order 111, to be changed and to provide uniformity for punishment. They also recommended that their rules committee consider reviewing this order to provide room for presiding officers to manage unique circumstances as when they arrive. They also recommended that the matter concerning both disorderly conduct be automatically referred to the Committee of Privileges for fair hearing before the House makes a decision on sanctions or penalties for the offences. They also proposed different sanctions and penalties for both disorderly conduct, like fines, salary cuts, suspensions, all these methods to deter members from such conduct. As I've alluded to the fact that there has been a recent amendment of the National Assembly Rules of Kenya, which is a third edition, which was adopted in June this year. Now that the new rules have kicked in, the old order of 111 has changed. So now it's no longer written as it is written now, in the slide, in slide 6, so it's no longer reading like that. It reads now as follows. If any member shall refuse to withdraw when required to do so, the Speaker or the Chairperson of the Committee, as the case may be, shall order such a member to be removed and such a member thereupon, without question put, be suspended from the service of the House for a minimum of 21 days and a maximum of 90 days. And shall, during this suspension, forfeit the right of access to the precincts of Parliament and the session exam shall take the necessary action to enforce the order. So the effect of this suspension would be that the member would forfeit the access to the precincts of the Assembly. Also the remuneration, the salary, the allowances as well would also be affected in this way. Thank you. and that was the recent development in Kenya. Moving along, the second parliamentary response that we received was the UK. The UK does not have a codified single document for instances that deals with powers and privileges. Both houses enjoy these privileges, which are listed in slide 8. Freedom of speech, controlled by the House of its, controlled by the House of its Affairs, which is exclusive jurisdiction of the House. Powers to discipline its own members for misconduct and punish anyone, whether a member or not, for contempt of Parliament. Exemption from Acts of Parliament within the precinct and either of either house unless they express provision that they should apply. Freedom from interference in going to and attending to and going away from Parliament, freedom from arrest in civil cases, exemption from subpoenas to attend court as witnesses, freedom from service of court documents within the parliamentary precinct, and absolute protection of all papers published by the order of the House. As noted earlier on, as I said, I'm just going to highlight, not to go into words to words now on. Article 9 of the Bill of Rights just establishes, what freedom of speech is in Parliament, and what I've already admitted to, and also we've noted the limitation on parliamentary powers and privileges, that the privilege belongs to the House itself. Individual members enjoy parliamentary privilege only as far as is necessary to perform their parliamentary duties, but they are subject to the general rule, the general law, in the same way as other citizens. So therefore, the right to free speech is limited to the rule of order. In the UK, in the past 10 years, they responded to say that they had a limitation on parliamentary privilege, which was published in 2012, and highlighting a number of issues, highlighting issues of privilege relating to police searches in the Parliament Estate in 2010, criminal prosecution of a group of former members. These are the matters that have reported, they have responded on our questionnaire. And this print paper was therefore put before the Joint Committee of Parliamentary Privileges, and the committee made certain recommendations that there should be the need for a privilege bill, which would codify parliamentary privilege. However, to date, this report has not yet been adopted or agreed to. UK also provides for contempt of Parliament procedure. They also have standing orders with regards to forceful removal of members from the House, as we have it here in South Africa. I'll move along to Canada. In Canada, they've got a provision for parliamentary powers and privileges. They've got Section 18 of the Constitution. As noted in slide 12, and also they've also got limitation to the parliamentary system. Canada basically is takes exactly the same form as the UK, as the UK is the model of all parliaments. There's also a provision for contempt by members. They also got provision as well for removal of members within the House as well. We'll move along to New Zealand. In New Zealand, this was the Parliamentary Procedures Act of 2014, and the recent developments in relation to parliamentary powers and privileges has actually was highlighted by that case called Attorney General Justin Lee. You find this case in the research paper on page 15 of the research paper, which explains what the court was about. I'll just briefly explain what the case was about. Ms. Lee was a communication advisor in climate change issues in the Ministry of Environmental, in the Ministry of Environment. She wrote to the Privilege Committee to complain about the minister's reference to her during a parliamentary question session in the House. So you see this would link with our Section 25 of our own legislation currently, whereby non-members could use this mechanism in order to hold executive members of parliament into account. So what she did is, as an official, she laid a complaint to the Privilege Committee. She was advised about the process of having a person's response incorporated into the parliamentary report. The minister later made a personal explanation to the House and apologized to Ms. Lane for the comments he had made that then was in 22 of November 2007. Ms. Lane went on the court to complain that the minister's answers in the House were a republication by Mr. Gough's statement. Mr. Gough is the deputy secretary in the ministry. So she alleges that whatever that the minister had said, it was because that deputy secretary had feed that information to the minister itself. So there were this matter went into the High Court, this matter went into an appeal court, as you can see in page 16. And basically what the Supreme Court concluded, that the statement that was made by the official, which is the official, if a statement is made by an official to a member for the purpose of replying to questions for oral answer were not themselves parliamentary proceedings, which is different to the interpretation that was given by the High Court, that it does amount to parliamentary proceeding, hence it has that effect of a privilege protection. However, then the Supreme Court disagrees with that, noting that such statements could not be the subject of court proceeding as they were not protected by absolute privilege. The decision was deferred to the Privilege Committee to consider the potential effect this might have on the future operations of the House. The committee disagreed with the Supreme Court's decision. It was of the view that the issue was not what the person outside the House needs expectation, but rather what the supply of information to members, to the minister, under an obligation to address the House in answering to parliamentary questions as an integral part of the proceedings in Parliament. That is in Canada. So the committee recommended as follows. The committee recommended as follows in slide 14 that the Privilege Committee consider the potential effect of the court decision and future operation of House and made the recommendation, and the fact that a bill, which is now the Act, it was a bill then in 2011, now it's an Act in 2014, which would clarify the nature of parliamentary privilege. And also the bill make explicit that a member or any person participating directly in or reporting on parliamentary proceedings who makes an oral or written statement that affirms or adopts what he or she or another person has said in the House will not be liable for criminal or civil proceedings unless statements could be defamatory. So that was the recommendation of the Privilege Committee. In New Zealand, they also have the forceful removal of members, which is standing order 89. You find that in slide 15. In Australia also has provisions in their constitution for parliamentary powers and privileges, also as contempt as well, that is in slide 16. forceful removal of members as well is also incorporated in MDR. Based on the responses that we've received from this parliament, it's evident that many of this parliament, except of course the UK, that has the constitution, they have a legislation in place that deals with parliamentary powers and privileges. And like any other parliament, they are also experiencing the challenges that South African parliament is also experiencing in respect of parliamentary privileges and immunities. It's changing and it's developing in each parliament. The responses seem to indicate that other parliaments have similar statutory rules, provisions with regards to parliamentary privileges, limitations on freedom of speech, rules provision for the forceful removal of members from the chamber for misconduct, and also have to deal with court challenges in respect to their decisions and processes. So you find that in most of the parliaments, they're using the UK as their model, and they're also in a developing stages with regards to powers and privileges. They're also grappling with the same challenges as the South African Parliament. Thank you.
Honourable members, I think we have had the history of the work done by the committee.
But I do think that in terms of our Powers and Provisions Act, we need to take our lead from the provisions of Section 58, which allow for freedom of speech of members in the House and in committees, but says that that freedom of speech can be limited in terms of the rules and orders of Parliament. And the second issue would be that our Constitution allows for absolute immunity against anything that is said in the House by a member. So in other words, anything that a member has said or revealed in the House, one cannot institute any civil or criminal proceedings against that member or arrest that member or sue that member for damages. So when we proceed with the review of our Act, I think our constitutional provision is the leading factor, as well as the recent DA judgment where the Constitutional Court has given guidance on some of those aspects.
Honourable members, we have the advantage of knowing what's happening in other jurisdictions, but our point of departure here is the Constitution of the Republic, which is binding, but we are grateful that we have had an opportunity to learn from other jurisdictions. So bearing those lessons from other jurisdictions, I think we will discuss how we tackle the matter in the light of our own constitutional rule.
Chairperson, yes, actually just the only comment that I wanted to make was it was an interesting exercise, but we have to bear in mind that all of these countries who respond to Parliament emanate and are well entrenched in the Westminster system. So, you know, England and the battle for democracy in England, and the whole reference to our Act as powers and privileges actually emanates from the limitation of the powers of the monarch. You know, centuries ago, we're talking 1689, the Bill of Rights. You know, it was that battle. So even when we come to naming our act, I think we should think new. And I know that New Zealand has done it. They call it the Privileges Act, because our constitution, section 58, refers to privileges as members of parliament, not powers. Powers are not vested in the members. Powers are vested in the institutions that are created through our constitution. So I think we will have to think about that, and I absolutely agree that we should not try. It is mostly an interesting exercise to understand where our Powers and Privileges Act comes from. And what is going to be very interesting is, clearly it was a revised act. It existed before the constitutional democracy came into being. And it was adjusted after then and called the Powers and Privileges Act, of 2004. But I think it's time for us now to look at the Act, to look at our also the primary role of the National Assembly to determine its own rules inside the House in terms of Section 57. And we must see that within those boundaries we retain a careful balance to make sure that we elaborate, because that's what Section 58 says. We may add additional provisions in terms of legislation, and I think one of the issues that we had to deal with was the fact that members of the National Council of Provinces were not covered through parliamentary privilege, freedom of speech legislation, until they were covered through the Privileges Act, Parliament Privileges Act. So we should just identify the gap, and then obviously deal with what the court instructed us to deal with. And the rest we should allow the rules of parliament to direct our proceedings. Thank you, Chairperson.
Comment before I allow further discussion. Honourable Gordon.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the presentation. I want to agree with my colleague with regard to the issue of the power and the privilege, that indeed there is a need to strike a balance and even to clarify that definition, that the allocated power really rests with the House and not the individual all the time. Like you, it rests with the individual when you are inside the House, but it is the authority that is given to the House, not the individual. So I want to agree with that point, and also say that maybe just to get clarity from the legal advisor as to how do you see us as Parliament you know, achieving a point where people are able to, members do not really abuse that privilege that has been allocated. How do we, because like we already have the role, and if you say that it's absolute, for me it creates a problem, because even the constitution does not provide absolute rights to individuals, because you know you trap on somebody's toes, you know, it's not allowed. Just to check on that one.
Because there are many individuals from many political parties, and if individuals have absolute power, and the power resides in the individual. themselves, that could be a recipe for anarchy. And the concerns that the members, for me, need to be addressed. Can you address this?
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe if I can just clarify. The Constitution doesn't provide for absolute powers or privileges. I mean, even 58.1a says members have freedom of speech in the assembly and the committee, subject to rules and orders, which means that rules and orders, which is made in terms of Section 57 of our Constitution, which is an internal process, can limit members' privileges. When I spoke about absolute, what I meant was is that the right granted in 58.1b is an absolute right. In other words, that right of where you cannot be sued for what you say in the House, or you cannot be criminally charged for what you say in the House, that is an absolute power. So you have freedom of speech, which can be limited in terms of, you know, when there's a disturbance being caused, but nobody can sue a member or impose an action of damages for what you say in the House. And that is an absolute power.
Thank you. Considering that there is nothing absolute, and what do you think is your absolute power? Is the soul and mind starts. So there are two different things here, power and privilege. You see, you can have the unfettered privilege to say what you want to say in the House, considering that the power lies resides in the institution, but the privilege is given to you by the institution that you cannot be sued for whatever you say. But that does not mean you could obviously abuse people and say it's your privilege. So, and considering our experiences here, when people seem to delight in unlawfulness willfully, the privileges can be sort of limited if you take advantage of that. Privilege is a privilege. It's conferred. It's not inherent. And since the power resides in the institution, so you cannot defy the institution and say it is your power, because you don't have the power. It's the institution that has the power. But the privilege, which is if it's conferred on you, can be withdrawn. So let's look into how we navigate between the two without actually making each one redundant also.
It would be correct if I understand you well, that the only thing that is absolute is freedom from prosecution. But otherwise, the exercise of this power, limited command and privilege are subject to limitation. But I don't want to speak for you. Can you address the members?
Yes, Chairperson, that's absolutely correct. The privilege that one has is the freedom of speech in the House or the committee, which according to the Constitution can be limited in terms of rules and orders. And perhaps table staff can speak about how it's actually done in the rules and orders. That's why I would agree with the Honourable Member when we say perhaps let's look at the name of the Act. It's not so much powers of the members, it's privileges and immunities of the members, and we can, you know, perhaps look into that. And as the Chairperson said, the only thing that is absolute is that a member won't be prosecuted or criminally charged for what you say in the House. And not even the rules of orders can allow for that to happen.
Okay, I just want to add a follow-up, because like we are dealing with an old document, and like it has got its own history to it, and like maybe research can be subjective. And also like I would suppose even this was subjective when it was written in the normal condition at that point based on the situation. So I just wanted to check on the issue of aren't we able to deal with this loan here at the current time, because like of course the intention was to ensure that there shouldn't be repression that was hitting me at that point. But at the moment, like there are many laws in the country that protect the right of freedom of expression, and supported by many other institutions that we have. So I just wanted to check to what extent can we tamper with that part, because if also if you go through the constitution, there is nowhere where they say that you lose your status. If you become a member of parliament, you don't lose your status as an ordinary citizen. You are a citizen and must comply with the law. On that part of the safeguarding of freedom of expression, you can say something that is totally destructive within the house and that is illegal in the house. And like, can we still regard that as part of the power, that absolute privilege that the member has? Because in my own opinion, I believe that even as members, we still have to respect the constitution, respect the law, and be custodians of the law. So that part, I have a problem with it, that absolute protection from prosecution, even if you are dealing with a matter that is threatening the state. Thank you.
That's a very interesting debate you are making, because as members of parliament, the first thing, we take an oath to uphold the constitution, which means whatever we do must not be in conflict with the constitution. Now the question then is that given this absolute right for prosecution, does it mean that you can just go and violate the constitution that you have you are forced to uphold? And so let me leave it.
I think the question of absoluteness in politics says that you can't absolutize anything. Is the starting point. And the question of absoluteness was during the medieval times, the divine right of kings, which have absolute power. So the constitution itself is the only thing that has got, would put the absoluteness in everything, although it can't be absolutized. Right? We do it so that in, on the judicial level, there is a modicum of arbitration that confers stability and predictability, that this is supposed to be like this, one is like this, but there is not absolute. There is the channels through which power is exercised. And if they are abrogated every day, you have to be defended all the time, because if you don't defend them, you lose them, the powers. And people being people, there are always challenges to these powers all the time to up the bar. And the word of mouth can be very powerful and very destructive. And if the constitution says you respect other people's privileges or rights, and you use your word of mouth to preach that. And because you are in Parliament, the way everybody, the whole world is listening to you, and you try to get away with it because you think you have absolute power of protection, you can't be prosecuted as long as you say it in the chamber, and you start a revolution out there or a rebellion, what happens to that? It will be too late to say, you are allowed to say it, you will be charged after if it happens to be seditious. There is nothing seditious if you have absolute right in the chamber. So whatever you say cannot be said is seditious, right? So maybe we are not legal eagles, but we would like to understand so that when we leave this chamber, we understood what we are saying, what is being said here.
Honorable Kimia.
Thank you, Chairperson. I see that this whole matter that we are actually focusing on an element, because that is what the Constitutional Court found to be unconstitutional. We are steering towards disruptions of the House and poor conduct of members. Now, we have tried very hard to establish a balance when we revise the rules, because remember, the Constitution is the ultimate law. So even if the Constitution says we have freedom of speech in the Assembly and its committees subject to its rules and orders, those very same rules and orders must comply with the Constitution. So we can't write into the rules and orders anything that would be found to be unconstitutional. So that was a very careful balance, so that we allow for vibrant debate, but that we also wanted to bring into the rules, and I specifically want to refer to Rule 82, where we say reference to member in respectful terms, because of the founding provisions of the Constitution, that we should respect each other. We may differ, but let us do so in a sort of in a decent manner, and not become not personalized matters, but rather debate issues on its merits and demerits. So, because we are still a young democracy and we come from a terrible history, we have to, can I say, we have to protect the freedoms with all we have. But we should make sure that it is also not abused. And I think that is why we brought in sections of unparliamentary and unacceptable language and gestures, Rule 84, etc., etc. Now, part of our problem, I must say, is that all of us are not protecting the House through its rules. We're not raising issues, points of order, on the basis of the rules. Because if we do that, we will actually empower our presiding officer to deal with matters. To say, honourable member, you are now defying the rule X, Y, and Z. Will you please refrain from doing that, and will you apologise to the House? Because ultimately, we must all participate to protect the House. Because that is the House of democratically elected representatives. So all I want to say is, if we say freedom of speech is not unlimited, yet it's only limited in as far as the rules limit them, and the rules may not be unconstitutional. But that is, you only protected from what you're saying in Parliament in terms of legal proceedings. So if you say X, Y, and Z, it's only that. I mean, you can debate that matter in the House, and you can, if you become really rowdy, etc., but the point is, you may not be criminally charged for what you say or what you present to Parliament. That's what the rules and what is the Constitution is saying. the Constitution is not giving you absolute protection. It's only that, and it is subject to the rules. But then our rules must be able to stand the test of constitutionality. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much, this is very interesting. I just want to get a clarity when the advisor here answering to this kind of questions. To say, in terms of trying to balance now the two, we talk about some, say, for example, you can't use unlimited weights and with that destructive. How then to determine if something is unparliamentary? For example, a member says something which I will consider unparliamentary or offensive. If you look at our diversity in terms of language, for argument's sake, let me make a typical example. Say, what happened the other day, the member said, you find that somebody takes offense of that. As far as the language in particular is concerned, that's acceptable, but to the other member, it's not. How then do you try to balance that?
Chairperson, I just wanted to add to this issue about absolute protection from criminal prosecution. Correct what the Honourable Member said, but that's not to say that the rules and orders can't subject a person who has created a disturbance to disciplinary action or other action. The protection only is against criminal proceedings, civil proceedings, arrest and imprisonment or damages. As far as the other issue about balancing what is unparliamentary, I'm afraid I'm not too okay with the rules. I'm going to hand over rather to the experts who are table staff who deal with the rules every day.
Thank you.
Well, Chair, I would say that the issue Mr. Mitchell is raising can be extremely difficult. There was the instance of the minister in the presidency, when she responded to one of the members in that way. And we had to advise the presiding officer on that issue. Unfortunately, we couldn't get an English equivalent because most of us were sitting around were not Zulu speaking. We went to the language section, and that's what they gave us. You know, and if it was wrong, unfortunately, I think maybe I could take that back. And also, I think the issue that I think Minister Bachani Tlamini about, I think like frog. It could be a metaphor, I don't know. You know, those are issues that are very difficult sometimes that we have to deal with. I'm sure also the cost of being issued all the time when they have to apply the rules.
If we are saying that the protection against criminal prosecution or civil action, and as Mr. Kiyama said, the rules provide limitations which would create the necessary checks and balance to ensure that people are free to express themselves. For instance, it would be said, don't cast as specialists unless you introduce a substantive motion. That's already a limitation. And someone says something, you say, look, this is unparliamentary. Those are the types of limitations which make sure that we don't go overboard. But I don't think that the law itself or the rules can be so detailed that you can prevent all these niceties. Otherwise, we'd be going so far as to suppress the dynamism a debate. For me, the important thing would be if you are protected against criminal prosecution, civil action, that would be the minimum. But the other issues can be dealt with in terms of the rules, and as the members are saying, provided the rules themselves are consistent with the Constitution, and there are many other laws which are important, Mr. Mandela. There are other laws that deal with the respect, and we don't need to reenact those other laws into this law. But I'm not the expert, I'll leave it to you.
Chairperson, if I can just also add, if you look at what Section 57 states, which gives the National Assembly the power to make its own laws, it says that the rules and orders which are made must give due regard to representative and participatory democracy, accountability, transparency, and public involvement. So the rules must obviously take these things into account as well to create that balance about what it entails.
So I think there are checks and balances that are clear to me. For our peoples, I think if we respect the protection against criminal prosecution, civil action, that should be the bottom line. And when we talk about absoluteness, it should be relating to those issues and not meaning that we can use the podium to call for a rebellion or the overthrow of government or the assassination of people saying it's your freedom of expression.
Just for the sake of now that we are ready. In English, if I say you are a dog, you can say I'm not an animal. What is he trying to say? I'm not an animal. But in Zulu, if I say uyinja, it means something much more than just saying you are an animal, isn't it? You are the lowest of the low, and it's very, very abusive. So if somebody speaks in Zulu and trying to get inside you so much and trying to get it through the privilege of the house, that there's nothing you can do about it. It's those things which we have to maybe help that checks and balances. You can only say, don't use abusive language, right? And this is not abusive language, it's an insult. It's very much deeper than just saying, ah, you are a thunderhead. Okay? So these are some of the things in the new rules that we have to come up with. There must be some sort of deterrent, not just to say, you comrade Dan Oxo, honorable member, don't use abusive language. Meanwhile, I keep on insulting you to an extent that you bear grudge and try to sort it outside there. So the rules and the checks and balances should say, what do we do if somebody goes overboard on this thing and keeps on going overboard and not wanting to, if just saying I withdraw doesn't mean anything, but you have said it, you help me, and say withdraw, I say, oh, I withdraw, you continue. It's not, we should make find ways of stopping that type of thing.
And then we get the expert advice.
Chairperson, we must just remember there is already an extensive list of earlier rulings by speakers of the House since its inception, and that is enforced. We may not liken any member to any animal. So that is a general rule that applies. And what we should be doing is, we have instituted in the new rules a disciplinary committee. And that is the one that must look at repeated contraventions of the rules by specific members. And I think we don't utilize those structures. But you must just bear in mind, there is no way that you can make a rule for every eventuality. the rules must broadly create an opportunity for orderly debate and to make sure that the House is performing its responsibilities in terms of the Constitution and its legislative mandate as well as its oversight role, etc. But within that, it is the presiding officers who must interpret the rules, but members must indicate that they insist that this member has now repeatedly done X, Y, and Z, and such a member should now be taken for a disciplinary, or they can bring such a request to the Rules Committee. So that we, because all of us jointly must accept responsibility for the decorum of the House. It's not the ruling party or opposition. I think we must jealously protect the decorum of the House, because yes, we can be alive in Parliament, we can have many spectators and people who watch parliamentary channel and other channels, but in the end we must not be so destructive that we cannot perform our responsibility in terms of the Constitution. And I just think that we must create that balance then.
Just in terms of what could happen when members breach the rules, one could be a simple ordinary breach of the rules, which is misconduct, and the member will be asked to leave the house. And if he refuses, if a member refuses, then he will be asked to leave the house, and if he refuses, then he will be forcibly removed the house. There is a much more serious misconduct, which is contempt of power. Then that's the dealt with in terms of legislation. This is the first of the Public Committee. And the sanctions are from a member being asked to apologize, up to being suspended, being fined, say the salary dumped. These are very serious.
So we really have checks and balances buried in the rules that are enforceable. But there are things that cannot be foreseen emanating from our multiple languages. People may use phrases from their languages, but the presiding officers will make rulings on that and novelties, and then the table staff to advise, and how we deal with some of the matters, you know, will evolve as we go on, and as the honorable members are saying, where there is no democracy, we shouldn't try to anticipate and suppress even actions which have not taken place. But I think we broadly agree that criminal prosecution and civil action absolute is the provision thereof. You want to move forward?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll now proceed with the presentation that we were tasked with, which is reviewing sections of the Act that might require review or amendments. At the outset, I must say that this committee was established for the purposes of reviewing the Act, so my presentation is limited to the Act. And any discussion about the rules and orders, I'm going to defer to the table staff. Our last presentation that was made to this committee only focused on provisions of the Act that were directly impacted by the majority judgment in the DA versus the Speaker Constitutional Court judgment. So it was a very limited presentation, and after that committee meeting, we were tasked by the chairperson to go and look at the entire Act and look at possible sections that might require review and possible amendments. What's in the presentation are just sections which we have identified, but obviously the committee will identify other sections. So in trying to fulfill this task, the process that we followed was that we perused all relevant judgments that either dealt with, challenged, or referred to the Powers and Privileges Act, and also those that dealt with parliamentary free speech. There weren't more, but any judgment that would have alluded to Section 57 about what the powers are and how far Parliament can go in making those rules we looked at. We obviously looked at the DA judgment and anything else that impacted on powers and privileges. We then also tried to get input from relevant officials working within Parliament, especially those that work with the Powers and Privileges Act. And we also asked legal advisors in the provincial legislatures for any comments that they might have, because this Act also applies to provincial legislatures. However, unfortunately, very limited input was received. We then also tried to get input from political parties, and this was a request made via the chairperson's office. Unfortunately, no responses were received. So what this presentation will do is just highlight sections of the Act that could possibly raise challenges, that must be vague or ambiguous, or that merely require a correction for consideration for this committee to review and to possibly amend. As I said earlier, the sections highlighted are based on our own views and observations, and also on the recent DA judgment. Now, before going into addressing those sections that we think might require review or amendment, I thought it would just be useful to recap the key findings of the DA judgment regarding Section 11. The first main finding that the court made was that the word person in the Act includes a member. Unless, the court says, the context itself dictates that it doesn't include the member. And an example of this would be Section 5 of the Act, where it would be clear that the word person in the first line could never be a member, because the member is not going to execute any service of summons. So that's always the penis. So the context there particularly identifies the fact that the word person there can never include a member. What the court also said, that another instance where the word person wouldn't include a member would be sections where this is specifically included. So if one looks then at Section 25.1 of the Act, it is clear that in the first line that that particular person doesn't include a member, because it's written in that manner where it says a person other than a member. The other main finding which the court made, which is what we were discussing earlier, is that parliamentary free speech, or the freedom of members to say, to have freedom of expression or to say what they want in the House or the committee, is subject only to rules and orders. So in other words, any limitation of this parliamentary free speech must only be contained in rules and orders and not be regulated in an Act. So it does not mean that parliamentary free speech cannot be limited. It can be limited, but it can only be limited in rules and orders and not in legislation. The Constitutional Court also then held that Section 11, which allowed for the arrest of a member, constituted an infringement of parliamentary free speech and directly infringed the immunity from criminal proceedings, arrest and imprisonment that is contained in Section 51.1b. The Section 11 of the Act was therefore found to be constitutionally invalid to the extent that it applied to members. Now, in order to remedy this defect, the court then read in the words, other than a member, after the word person in Section 11, so that it was clear that Section 11 only applied to non-members and not to members. Now, I just wanted to say that these are the key findings, and so when we look at the issue of parliamentary free speech, we need to review the Act or go through the Act to ensure that any provision that deals with parliamentary free speech is actually taken out of the Act, because any limitation of parliamentary free speech can only be contained in the rules and orders. Now, having said that, the first section which I identified that might require possible review is Section 7E of the Act. Now, Section 7E of the Act is entitled Prohibited Acts in Respect of Parliament and Members. And what Section 7E states is that a person may not, while Parliament or a House or Committee is meeting, create or take part in any disturbance within the precinct. Now, Section 7E must be read with Section 13 as well as Section 27. Section 13 of the Act is a provision dealing with conduct constituting content. So what Section 13 does is it provides that a member is guilty of contempt of Parliament if the member contravenes the whole of Section 7, including Section 7E, which is the creation or taking part in any disturbance in the precinct. Section 27, on the other hand, provides that a person, including a member, who contravenes Section 7, commits an offence and is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 3 years, or to both a fine and imprisonment. Now, the word person in Section 7 definitely includes a member. And the reason for that is that when you read Section 27.1, it was of the Act, it says that a person, including a member, who contravenes Section 7, commits an offence. So that word person definitely includes the member, which means then a member who creates a disturbance anywhere on the precinct will be liable for criminal prosecution. But having said that, I must say that we must take note of the fact that precinct in the Act includes not just the chambers or the committee rooms or the houses. It includes any area of land. It includes the forecourt, the yard or garden outside the chambers. But we must remember that parliamentary free speech is only protected for what the member has said in the assembly, the council or his meeting. But precinct, however, includes the houses as well as the forecourts and whatever. But the protected conduct is only conduct that happens in the house or a committee room or a committee meeting or a council. So Section 7E, read with Section 13, which is your content provision, as well as Section 27, which is your provision which creates offences, can be seen as a limitation on or regulating parliamentary free speech, which is contained in Section 58.1 of the Constitution, where such disturbance occurs in the Assembly, the Council or Committee. And this regulation then is contained in an Act, whereas our Constitution says that parliamentary free speech can only be limited in the rules and orders. And the reason why I said that it can be seen as their limitation would be that the effect of Section 13, which provides that a member may be in contempt of Parliament for creating or taking part in a disturbance in the precinct, it limits freedom of speech in an Act. And the DA judgment has said any limitation of free speech must be contained in rules and orders, especially where that free speech has occurred in a House or a Committee. The same can be said of Section 27, where a member can be held criminally liable for creating or taking part in a disturbance in the precinct, again, this is something which is dealt with in the rules and orders, and it then impacts on the immunities which are protected in section 58.1b and 71b of the Constitution. Now, a possible way of correcting this is to delete section 7, paragraph E from section 7, renumber that as section 7.1, and then insert a new section, 7.2 and 7.3, to read as follows. 7.2 would read, a person other than a member may not, while Parliament or a House or Committee is meeting, create or take part in any disturbance with the precinct. So 7.2 will apply to members of the public only, where that disturbance is happening in the House, in a committee room, or anywhere else on the precinct. Then we add 7.3, which provides that a member may not, while Parliament or a House or Committee is meeting, create or take part in any disturbance. But then Part B would say that the disturbance does not include any act which amounts to the exercise of freedom of speech in the Assembly or its committees as contemplated in Section 58.1. So in other words, by doing this, we will clear the act of dealing with any limitation on parliamentary free speech where that is, where such parliamentary free speech is in the House or a committee or the Council.
Can the presenter repeat 7.3 the way she is proposing to be crafted?
What I'm saying there is that you have two parts to 7.3. The first would be a member may not, while Parliament or a House or Committee is meeting, create or take part in any disturbance within the precinct. Now this would then include then a disturbance that happened in the yard, where parliamentary privilege is not protected. So you would then add the Part B to say that if that disturbance is in the House or a committee room, that wouldn't then be an offence or contempt, because then you will then clear the act of dealing with any limitation of parliamentary free speech in an act, but for that to rather be dealt with in the rules.
There was a time when we were in a sitting in a committee room, and the union people came and walked on the tables, and that is in the chamber. Does this section 3, 7.3 be excluded?
Section 7.2 would cover an instance like that. So section 7.2 will relate to a person who is not a member creating a disturbance anywhere on the precinct, which will be in the House, the committee room, the foreyard, the forecourt, the gardens, etc.
Is that not the same as preventing a protest within the precinct of Parliament? Is that allowed? Protesters
But remember, what you would want to do is you would want to say that that could be an offence if somebody is creating a disturbance that does not allow for the proceedings of Parliament to proceed. Then the other option, which requires a little bit of more thinking, but I thought I'd just put it in here, is to, instead of going with option 1, is to go with option 2, to perhaps amend the definition of disturbance to exclude any of the acts that amount to the exercise of freedom of speech in the House. And the word disturbance is only really used in Section 7 and Section 11, but one would have to really think about whether that's the better way to go or whether it's option one. So it's something that the committee can discuss. The next section that I found would possibly require a review is Section 7, Paragraph 8, Item I, where it provides that a person may not fail or refuse to comply with instruction by a duly authorized staff member regarding the presence of persons at a particular meeting in the precinct. Now, I think that this section appears to be vague. It's not clear what is meant here and which person is being referred to and when this would be applicable. So I think we would need to get more clarity on what the intention was for this particular section. And once we know what that is, we'd have to then, you know, review the section and make it more clearer. Then the other section that I'd like to highlight is the section that was the topic in the DA judgment, which is Section 11. And what we proposed in here is that the read-in judgment, the read-in provision that was provided for in the judgment, be incorporated here so that a presiding officer or chairperson or person designated by the speaker or chairperson may still arrest a member of the public who creates or takes part in any disturbance in the precinct. The next section is Section 12F, 5F. Now before I go into what the amendment is here, there are many sections in the Act that provide a list. And normally, one would add the word or the word and just at the end of the second last item in the list to provide clarity whether all of those need to be present in a particular instance or whether just one of them needs to be. So for example, if one looks at section 14.3, there's a list that's provided there which says what the summons must include, and at the end of section 14.3e, the word and is put there, which means that all of that needs to be included in the summons, not just one of them to the exclusion of the other, all of it. But there are lots of other sections in the Act that neither has an or an and at the end of the second last item in the list. One of those sections is section 12.5, which at the end of paragraph F is neither an or nor an and, but because this is a list of the penalties that one may impose on a member who is found guilty of contempt, it is suggested that the word or be added at the end of paragraph F just so that it complies with drafting convention, but also so that things are clearer, that not all of these penalties need to be applied, just one of them or more than one of them can be done, not all of them need to. Then the next section is section 22, where section 22 uses the phrase is liable in damages, and we would suggest that that's not a phrase that's so commonly used in legislation. The phrase more widely used is liable for damages, and the last time I saw the phrase in liable damages being used was in the 1963 Act, so we suggest that the phrase be changed to liable for damages. It's not going to change the substance of the provision, but it would...
I'll just suggest that when members want to intervene, just speak into the mic, so I might be reading and obviously...
Thank you. So, Chairperson, maybe before she goes ahead, I'm trying now to see under these powers, like the Speaker and the Chairperson of the Committee, they're checking the committee, we are referring like to the portfolio committee. It is so. So, if a member is suspended by the committee,
what impact does it have to the House where I mean the Speaker is in charge? Because you say the member must not be in the kingdom of the Parliament. But now say the chairperson of the committee is suspending the member in the committee, not in the House. I'm trying to say this, and I don't know about the chairperson of the committee and the Speaker.
I'm not too sure if the chairperson can suspend the member. In terms of this Act, if you look at Section 12, the power to suspend or to impose any of these penalties is made by the House. And the Powers and Privileges Committee is a committee that would look into the inquiry but would make recommendations to the House. But Victor can correct me.
Yes, that is correct. The Powers and Privileges Committee will come into the House. The House will decide.
It means that a member in the committee can be so disruptive that he or she completely stops the proceedings of the committee, and then you will have to go back to the House. Doesn't the chair of the committee have inherent powers delegated by the Speaker to ensure that the proceedings in the committee are not disrupted to the next?
I think also we must be mindful that there are other bigger committees like the ETC, where they are chaired by the presiding officer, and also taking into consideration that our colleague there from the MA table mentioned earlier that there are minor offences that can be dealt with in-house and other major offences that can be referred to broader committees that means, you know, FIFA penalties. So maybe it's in that context, the way I understand it. Thank you.
Because the chairing committees and EPCs or mini plenaries should be exercising powers delegated by the Speaker. And if you disrupt those committees, you should actually be disrupting Parliament itself.
So how do you understand that?
Yeah. My question of the rules now, I was trying to get the rule that speaks to when the issue about the member, that's disruptive. From what I understand the rules, the chairperson must support the member to the Speaker. But the chairperson doesn't have the power to suspend a member out of the presence of Parliament, from my recollection of the rules. The power in the EPC, the presiding officer, which could be House Chairperson, could bring in the sergeant arms to remove the member. But there are situations where the presiding officer is not necessarily the House Chair, but a member or a chair of the committee that is requested to chair an EPC, which means that the powers of the House Chairperson then in that case that the delegated to that chair of the committee. Can I come back on that one later? That's the board.
Chair, I would think that the chairperson, if he or she can suspend a member, it could be from the committee, but not from the precinct. I'll think that.
The chairperson, actually the chairperson of committee, they have specific functions listed in the rules, and one of them is not any disciplinary function. The chairperson, if a member is repeatedly disruptive, etc., the member can be reported and there can be disciplinary action taken. But the chairperson of the committee cannot expel a member from any proceedings of the committee. And you know that it is important that the right to silence a member is very key. Well, can I say it should not be ordinarily done for a member to be silent in a committee and thereby to expel a member from the proceedings of the committee. So chairperson's rights are and responsibilities are listed in Rule 158. Committee must elect one of its members. The chairperson of the committee, subject to the provisions of these rules, presides at meetings and may act in a matter on behalf of in the best interest of the committee when it's not practical to arrange a meeting of the committee, etc. But the committee chairpersons actually have limited rights. They must maintain the order within the proceedings of the committee, but limited. So, thank you, Chair.
So, will we allow you to come back on that, but I want to assume that committees are organs of parliament, and they exercise those powers in furtherance of the work of parliament. Now, if we had malicious people who just want to disrupt the work of parliament, so then we continue, and we don't read into their powers, their ability to exclude members from proceedings, what does it mean? Does it mean that Parliament may actually be brought to a halt, committee brought to a halt, but let's allow you to come back to us unless you have
a question. But just on the mini-plenary, Rule 56 provides for order in meetings and rules of debate in a plenary, in a mini-plenary, which is the former ETC. In addition to the rules, are applicable to plenary sessions of the House, are also applicable to the proceedings of a mini plenary session. And one of the chairpersons of mini plenary sessions are able to do is to keep ruling. And if a member refuses to abide by the ruling, she or he can order the member to either to comply or to withdraw from the House. And therefore, he or she will be able to invoke Rule 73, which provides for the removal of members. That is in relation to mini plenary sessions.
That's covered, but not the qualities. Yeah. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, I understand because my concern.
Before you come in, I think there's another
information.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of Rule 188B, it deals with the removal of persons, and it says when instructed by the chairperson of a committee or subcommittee, the sergeant at arms must remove or arrange for the removal of any person who B disrupts the proceedings of the committee or subcommittee or causes a nuisance. I think that addresses the concern of the member.
Thank you, Chairperson. Then the next section I want to highlight is section 23.2a. Again, this is the instance where the word and or all was not inserted. So it's suggested that the word all be added at the end of paragraph A. Then the next section is 24, paragraph A, which provides that when a member of the National Assembly or permanent delegate to the NCLP has been convicted, the registrar of the clerk of the court sentencing that person must in writing inform the speaker. Now this whole debate has been about when does person include member, when does person include member and member of the public. So I'm just suggesting in that instance to make it clear that the word person is really just a reference to the member or the permanent delegate, that the word person in section 24A be changed to read member or that permanent delegate so that the provision is clear. The next provision is section 25.2, which provides that a person who has been aggrieved by a statement may submit a written request to the secretary to have a response recorded. Then subsection 2 then provides that the committee must publish the response of the person in the appropriate parliamentary paper. It's not clear then if that person referred to in section 25.2 refer, who it refers to. Does it refer to the member who made the remark? Does it refer to the witness? Does it refer to the aggrieved person? When I consulted the MA table, they explained that the purpose of the section is to afford members of the public who feel aggrieved by certain statements or allegations that were made against them, for them to have an opportunity to submit their responses to these statements. In other words, it provides a form of a redress mechanism and an opportunity for the other side to be heard. So what I'm suggesting there is that section 25.2 be made more clearer, so that we add the word aggrieved before the word person, so that we know that the response that's being recorded is the one of the aggrieved person. Again, with regard to section 28.2e, this is again an instance where the word or and was not included, and I'm suggesting that the word and be added at the end of section 28.2e. The next section, which I feel is again a similar instance of the word or and I'm suggesting that the word or be added at the end of paragraph A. Section 50 is the next section which I felt can be made more clearer by inserting the word member instead of the word person, so that one knows that it is the member that must be informed when the clerk sentences a member, so it's not just any person. Then the next section is section 32, where if you look at the short title of the Act, it says that this Act is called the Powers, Privileges and Immunities of Parliament and Provincial Legislatures Act. But if you look at the number of the Act, on the first page of the Act that was gazetted, it says Act Number 4 and the year is 2004. So the short title differs with the name of the Act and the year of the Act that's indicated on the first page. And this often happens when an Act is introduced, or a bill is introduced in 1 year, but it's actually adopted in the following year, and then that's an oversight where the year in the short title is not amended to reflect the year in which the Act was actually assented to and given a number. So I'm suggesting that the 2003 in section 32 be corrected to 2004, so it won't, to avoid any confusion as to which Act we're referring to. Now those are some of the sections that we highlighted. But as I said earlier, we also sought comments from some of the provinces. And the first comment we received was that section 3 of the Act also be made applicable to provincial legislatures. Now if you look at section 28 of the Act, section 28 will identify all the sections in the Act that should apply to provincial legislatures with the necessary changes. The comment we got was is that they can't see any reason why section 3, which provides for who exercises control and authority over a precinct, not has been made applicable to provinces with the necessary changes. In other words, to say there that the presiding officer of that provincial legislature is in control of the precinct of the provincial legislature or something. So it is not clear why section 3 was omitted, and I feel that there would be no harm unless there were valid reasons for the exclusion, which I'm not aware of. The next section made was that we received a comment from one of the provinces to say that section 12, which deals with the penalties that a house may impose on a member who's filing contempt, and it also deals with the workings of the Powers and Privileges Committee, they suggested that some kind of internal appeal mechanism be built into Section 12. However, we asked them for motivation as to why and what are the reasons for this, because our view is that it is the House, upon recommendation from the Powers and Privileges Committee, that will make a decision and make a decision on the penalty. So there is no higher decision-making body to which one can make an appeal. But to date, we've not received any clarification or motivation for that. And then another comment we received was that small legislatures cannot establish a standing committee as contemplated in Section 12. They say it's not always practical for a provincial legislature to have a standing committee, and in small legislatures, in order to avoid conflicts of interest, the membership of the disciplinary committee must often be changed each time a disciplinary is heard. Now, Section 12 then provides that a standing committee be appointed to deal with content of Parliament.
Training was booked until 13 hours. We have an extension until 4:15. So if you can just speak to, you know, where there are no challenges, don't go through that. Just highlight where there are challenges so that we can round up.
Chairperson, I think I just have 2 slides left, but I need your call. So I think one way to address this is to include a subsection 3 into section 28 to say that for the purposes of section 12, a provincial legislature may choose to either appoint a standing committee or establish an ad hoc committee. Then in conclusion, these are merely sections highlighted for the committee to consider for possible review and amendments. And then once the committee decides on which sections of the Act to amend, consideration will then be given to the most appropriate manner in which to amend, and also include any consequential amendments that arise from those amendments. Thank you.
Any other contribution on the vote?
Thank you very much. I just wanted to check on something that I saw on Section 12. Clause 11, where it talks about the remuneration, that a member will not get the remuneration. But I don't know, whether we are going to stipulate the types of penalties or if they are recorded elsewhere. Maybe I can be helped on that one. On that area of the penalties. So this act is not going to stipulate the penalties.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, first of all, just thank you to Legal Services for the presentation. I just wanted to ask, maybe it's just because my memory needs some refreshment, but I just want to understand what the court has found between the description of free speech and causing a disturbance. And I'm concerned that we are making it the same. Protect freedom of speech, which is clearly constitutional, but how do we then extend freedom of speech by extending the right to create a disturbance? And then we still regard that as part of freedom of speech. Could legal terms perhaps just explain that? But just the final thing that I wanted to suggest, Chairperson, because I know we are running out of time, is that that we have received the presentation and the suggestion. I would request that we actually ask legal services that they proceed with the drafting, and that they check maybe additional matters raised today in discussion so that we can clearly differentiate I would be very concerned if we change section one with reference to disturbance. I think a disturbance is a disturbance. Whether you are a member or not a member, you don't have excessive rights beyond your freedom of speech. But, you know, that is a personal view. But clearly, if we could then just get a general feeling from them how long it will take and by when we will have a first draft. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, because you have the freedom of speech, but obstruction of the business of the committee or the business of parliament, that should be something else. You are obstructing the work. That's not freedom of speech, but can you respond to that? And then agree on the way forward as you propose.
With regards to the first question about the list of penalties, the list of penalties are in section 12.5, and one of the penalties is that you can suspend a member with or without remuneration. So if you look at 12.5G, that is one of the penalties that the House can impose on a member who found in contempt of court. On the issue of protection of speech versus disturbance, the court was looking particularly at the wording of Section 11, which allowed for the arrest of any person who causes a disturbance in the precinct. So Section 11 meant that you could ask for the arrest of a member and a non-member who causes a disturbance as defined in the Act anywhere on the precinct, not just in the House, but also the forecourt and so forth. So when looking at whether Section 11 imposed on freedom of speech, the court did say that that privilege in 58.1 can never go so far as to give members a license to disrupt the proceedings of Parliament. And then it went on to look to see what does disturbance entail. And it regarded disturbance as being overly broad, that it could include any act that could interfere with the proceedings of Parliament. But then the court went further and saying, surely it's not just every and any act that amounts to a disturbance that would warrant a removal. The reach of the disturbance must be of such a nature that it hamstrings or incapacitates the proceedings from carrying on in a reasonable period of time. So that is how the court linked freedom of speech with disturbance in terms of how the Act had defined it. But we will definitely look into the definitions again, how to link it up with freedom of speech in the review. Then with regard to when a first draft is due, Chairperson, I'm at your liberty. I'm at here until the 15th of December and I'm back early next year. So I'll be ready with the first draft when you tell me.
In Barcelona for under the ambit of disturbance.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
I wanted to know whether Philip Bastring fall under the category of disturbing the proceedings of the House.
I think if one looked to see what the court said, the disturbance must incapacitate the proceedings. So if the proceedings cannot go ahead because there's just no decorum in the House, people can't hear one another and whatever, that would amount to disturbance. Obviously, one would have to decide it on a case-by-case analysis. More than that, the court didn't actually say what a disturbance would entail.
Yeah. Can we then agree that we go back and redraft the amendment with the lights of the discussion, and then we had an extension until the 29th of June to finalize the site. And then we have requested that we meet between the 23rd and the 25th of January, so that the bill must be ready before us. And then we will consider the amendments and then take further discussion, so that we meet the deadline of the 29th of June 28th. We must be happy with those deadlines, and then the deadlines within reach. And that will then bring us to the end of the proceedings, and we really must thank you for the good work done. And we really have had challenges with attendance, but despite that, I think we were able to discharge our mandate on Parliament yesterday, but for the extension to the 29th of June, 29th of June 28th. So we'll be able to meet the deadline that was set by the court. The meeting is